Free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net to see our past shows and get archives for the shows you want to listen to. Our guest today is Ingo Valentin, the inventor of the Valentin Technologies hydrostatic powertrain. This is a 130 mile per gallon car technology, and he's going to be talking to us about how this works. It is a contender for the X Prize, which is going to award a high mileage engine vehicle technology. Thank you for joining us, Ingo.
Yes, hello. Sorry, how are you?
I'm doing very good, and I appreciate you joining us. Tell us about this vehicle that you have come up with, the hydrostatic powertrain.
The hydrostatic powertrain is commonly used in heavy equipment. So it's a known technology. The drawbacks are the powertrains are very efficient currently, and it's very expensive. I have a significant background in this area of this technology and have applied the technology to cars. And so the functioning of the car is each wheel has one hydraulic motor driven by energy from the accumulator, which is a hydraulic battery, and this drives the car.
So you have a hydraulic, battery, you're calling it a battery. It's basically a chamber that contains the pressure of the hydraulic fluid. Is that another way of saying that?
Yes, it's a better way of saying it. It's so-called an accumulator, which stores pressurized fluid and supplies wheel motors with hydraulic energy, with pressurized fluid.
So you have an engine that pumps hydraulic fluid into this accumulator or this chamber of hydraulic fluid, and that fluid then drives the four wheels, one on each of the four wheels of the vehicle, and then as this car is decelerating and braking, that goes into regenerative power to repressurize the accumulator, and then the engine is not connected directly to the wheels, but only to the chamber, which maintains the pressure of the hydraulic fluid. And through this combination, you're getting a fuel efficiency of 130 miles per gallon on average. And tell us how far along you are, just to kind of give us an upfront indication of how far along are you in actually getting this to the commercial marketplace.
I have designed and tested the hydraulic motor, which is located in the wheel and drives the wheel. I have designed and tested them, and the next step would be then to build an advanced version of this motor, slight modification in a smaller size to be able to apply to the car, the X-Prize car, which participates on the race.
What if you don't win the X Prize? Are you still going to be able to go forward without the money that would come from that?
I'm very convinced, since I don't know any better concept, that the chances to win are relatively good. So, on the other hand, considering the case I wouldn't win the X Prize, I would license the technology to manufacture of current hydrostatic powertrains. Because the powertrain in the current form I am developing is lighter, more efficient, and noticeably lower on cost.
And this would require a ground up, from the ground up, design of a vehicle to put over this chassis, so the powertrain that you would be developing, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So the powertrain.
So you would develop an automobile company similar to Tesla Motors company.
Excuse me?
You would develop a motor vehicle company that would do everything from the ground up, similar to Tesla Motor Company?
Yes. No, I would, my plan is, and has been from the beginning, I would produce the three-piston engine that charges the accumulator with pressurized fluid, and also would produce the wheel motors. And I would say the, I'm planning that the remaining parts, I mean the accumulator and the car body, is designed by current manufacturers, or designed and produced by current manufacturers.
Would you be able to use an existing design, or would they make a design specific to your vehicle?
It would make sense to use a new design, at least, a new design, because the car body I'm using is significantly less important than currently. So therefore, the car body is one part of the car, and the powertrain with the accumulator, which builds a complete platform for the car, is the other part. And I have no plan to produce any kind of car bodies.
Okay. Now, the engine that you that drives this, you're calling it a free piston engine. Maybe you could explain what that's about.
A free piston engine is an engine which transfers the pressure from the combustion directly into hydraulic pressure, and this kind of hydraulic pressure is then stored or pumped into the accumulator. The advantage of a free piston engine is it is very simple, very durable, and very efficient. This type of engine is basically known, has also been tested in some cases in the vehicle. The current Stirling engines have several shortcomings, but besides the shortcomings, they are very efficient. My design is a little bit different and improves the efficiency further. So the efficiency of the current Stirling engine will be about 10% below current engines. And the engine is at the same time very small and very light. So both or all three items, low cost, low weight, and very efficient, are very attractive for the powertrain.
I want to make a point in reading through some of your literature. When somebody thinks of a 130 mile per gallon car, they might picture in their mind a very low or a small vehicle with no power. But you actually have, 780 horsepower combined with the four wheels. Is that
correct? Yeah. The whole design of the car is made in a way that the powertrain can absorb all the energy which comes up during braking. Typically, when you brake, you use a disc brake, so they become very hot. And this energy is transferred instead of in heat into hydraulic pressure and then transferred back into the accumulator. So the layout of the car is such that the powertrain, that the wheel motors can absorb all the energy from braking. So you don't feel any difference in braking because they're as good or even better than disc brakes. But the energy is transferred into hydraulic pressure and then sent back to the accumulator. Then the wheel motors have it, and for this kind of function, you need about 750-800 horsepower to stop the car. And the wheel motors can absorb these 800 horsepower or 770 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, obviously, you can use the same energy to accelerate the car. It means you have available for a relatively light car 700 or 800 horsepower, which is enormous. So the powertrain computer from the powertrain will limit the acceleration because I think nobody would be able to handle such kind of acceleration.
0 to 62 miles per hour in 5 seconds.
I mentioned 5 seconds, so to show it's more than enough. Actually, it will be below 3 seconds. But what I said before, somebody in a car, normal driver in a car, which accelerates from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 2.5 or 2.8 seconds, it's just dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I understand right, there's also an electrical component in your vehicle where you can. There's a plug-in aspect where you could run the vehicle for 15 minutes just on battery power, not on the hydrostatic. Or the hydraulic power.
And pressure. the outlet, I have considered, or I'm including, the electric power supply, but the electric power is from the solar panel or from a plug-in in your garage, is only there to charge the accumulator. So you have basically a little electric motor which transfers the energy from the plug or from the solar panel, charges the electric motor, and the electric motor drives a pump which fills the accumulator with pressurized fluid. So the concept doesn't change. Only you, instead of charging the accumulator by the combustion engine, the accumulator is charged by a little electric pump.
So you have an electric pump input to the accumulator as well as the engine input to the accumulator. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes. So only the I think when you have an outlet in the garage, you can maybe maximum produce, let's say, 1.5 or 2 horsepower, and the engine has obviously much more horsepower and therefore can fill the accumulator faster.
What about climbing hills? Where you, I can see where in a hydraulic system you could have a short-term fast pickup, for example, 0 to 60 miles per hour in 3 to 5 seconds. But what about a long haul going up a steep grade? Let's say you're going over a pass, for example.
Yes.
How would it hold up for that, where you've got an engine that's running, that's keeping the hydraulic pressure up? Your engine basically is going to need to be able to maintain a high pressure over a long distance.
Yes.
How will it perform in that scenario?
Yeah, that's correct. This is a key item in the layout of the powertrain. The acceleration is only a matter of energy stored, while when you climb, what we said already, when you climb a long incline or pull a heavy load, let's say trailer, for a longer period of time, then the stored energy really doesn't help a lot, only for a short time. So for the long incline on a mountain, for example, you need an engine which is powerful enough to maintain, let's say, for several hours, principally, the incline performance. And that's the reason why the three-piston engine has, I think, 60 horsepower. 60 horsepower are needed to pull the car over a long distance uphill. And 60 horsepower for a light car, the car is lighter, about one-third. The 60 horsepower for the light car would be about 90 horsepower for an average car. And this is sufficient to have a certain grade for indefinite amount of time.
Mm-hmm. So that would basically be designed per the consumer interest if they have need to be able to haul heavy loads up long inclines. They would want a higher rated engine than the one that is going to be just on more flat or short inclines.
Yes.
Where the hydraulic power could accommodate a short incline.
Yes. And may I add to the subject? The engine, what I said before, had about 60 horsepower. When you go about, let's say, 65 miles an hour on a highway, on a flat without incline, it would be sufficient to have, let's say, maybe 12 or 15 horsepower because you don't need the energy. So the engine of the car, the hydrostatic powertrain, has the 60 horsepower only for the one purpose, to be able to go a long incline. Otherwise, the engine could be much smaller.
Now, the link on your website to the XPRIZE press release, where they announced 30 official contenders for the XPRIZE. How closely have you looked at your competition in terms of what you're up against?
I have taken a brief look at all of them. I knew some of them. I think it was Tesla Motors from California and Lorimo, I believe, from Munich, which show a complete car concept. In other cases, the people really do not have proposed a certain concept or haven't shown enough detail to find out what they actually plan to do.
What are the qualifying parameters for the XPRIZE? What is it that's going to determine the winner of the XPRIZE?
I think they have planned two races, one kind of pre-qualification race, and then the several winner, or the best 10 or whatever, will then participate on the final race. And the race is determined, or the winner finally is determined by the time needed to cover the whole range. of the race, basically who's the fastest. But other things are considered. Obviously, fuel consumption has to be met. Pollution is met, is measured. Then the for each driving cycle, the fuel consumption. Then they require a certain space conditions for the passenger. They require safety, that the safety factors are met, and they require also a trunk of a certain size. So they want basically a normal four-seat passenger car, which has very high mileage and is a step forward. That's their goal. So not a streamlined car, like a cigar-shaped car, which makes, I think some make already 1,500 miles a gallon, but they're obviously totally unpractical for daily use.
So basically they want a high-mileage passenger vehicle.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
They state officially that they evaluate the quality of the car, but they also rely heavily, and that's what they definitely state, they rely heavily on customer opinion. So if the car meets all requirements but people don't like it, then the chances to become the winner are reduced.
So there's a sex appeal, so to speak?
Yes. I think justifiably, because why designing a car when people don't like it, or when people cannot use it on a regular basis?
Now, so the prototype that you're going to be running in this race is going to need to look pretty good then?
Yes, at least, yes, I would say look, should be appealing. I assume that the public will overlook some, I shouldn't say flaws, but would not expect here a supercar with looks like a Ferrari for daily use, but the technical data should be at least meet the requirements, I mean 100 miles per gallon and higher, and also the environmental condition regarding emissions, and decent space or good space, four doors, a trunk, everything you need during daily commuting.
How much does sticker price weigh?
They assume that the car will be more expensive than currently, but I think they say pretty much when you come up with a car for daily usage, which costs $80,000, the appeal will be drastically reduced, and I agree with it. The car, I think people expect some more cost for the car because it offers low mileage and low pollution, or high mileage and low pollution, and therefore they are willing to pay, let's say, that's my opinion, they are willing to pay 10% more than they get this kind of qualified car. But obviously when the car costs 2 times as much, it's already, the chances are limited. They evaluate, or the X-Price Foundation evaluates the attractiveness based on the cost figure and assumes that at least 10,000 cars per year are produced. So they don't expect 5 million cars a year, they expect 10,000 cars a year for this kind of price range up to, let's say, maximum twice the money.
At that rate of production, 10,000 cars per year, how do you expect your sticker price to come in compared to conventional vehicles?
10,000 is, from my point of view, a compromise. Obviously, 1,000 are relatively easy to sell. 10,000 is something between, I assume, and it's my belief. When the technology target can be met, it means high mileage, low pollution, good space conditions, then there is no car with 10,000 production. This would be at least 100,000 cars per year. And considering 100,000 cars a year, let's say, after a period of 5 years or 4 or 5 years, then the costs will be competitive with current cars. Because you might have seen on my website that the powertrain will be the platform, means the wheel motors, the accumulator, and the engine will be a little bit more than currently because the accumulator is relatively.
And you think you can get that in 5 years from now?
You mean the car?
Yeah, do you think you can get to the 100,000 car per year mile in 5 years?
After the race, 5 years are definitely sufficient to produce a car, 100,000 parts, 100,000 cars a year, after the race has been done. Right now,
And when is the race?
The race is planned for 2009, the first race, the pre-qualification race. I think it's in the second quarter of 2009, and the final race is for early 2010. So from this point of view, let's say from the middle of when you know the, or when it's known the car fulfills requirements, all requirements is important, then it would be realistic to invest capital to start production. And then I would say 4 years, let's say the first cars 2 years later, and then let's say 100,000 would be realistic 4 or 5 years later.
And how much do you get for the prize on the X Prize?
The X Prize talked initially about the same conditions as for the Ansari X Prize, which was a prize for the first commercially developed spacecraft in 2004, and they gave a grant or a prize of $10 million. And this should be the same here for the Automotive X Prize, but at least they say right now in the $1 million range. I think it depends on how much sponsorship they get from people who are following the same target.
Of course, I would think also that the publicity and the follow-up venture capital interest would be very significant upon winning that prize.
Yes, I agree.
When is the cutoff date for applying to be in the race?
I cannot say so offhand. I have signed a letter of intent that I will participate, and I think it was planned for early next year, I believe, that the people can apply. But I think the you can enter the race relatively late. Obviously, you have to fulfill the conditions.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your solar panel on another subject. You plan on integrating a solar panel on the roof of your vehicle. How much energy is being generated by that? What technology are you going to use? And what is that going to add to the price of the vehicle?
Price is shifting, and I assume that it obviously gets better, lower and lower over time. I have more concern on this, and in long terms, it will pay off. This is not so that it's a luxury item which doesn't have any payback. The solar panel of about 10-11 square foot would provide enough energy that the accumulator can be filled in about 3.5 to 4 hours. So when you park your car outside, you would have, every 3.5 or 4 hours. It means 3 charges a day, which then driven 5-6 miles, that charge about would be 18-20 miles. The cost, I cannot mention any exact data right now.
So a car sitting in the sun for 3 to 4 hours could run for 18 to 20 miles. If it got shady at that point, if the sun was out continuously, you could go maybe, 25 miles?
No, at first the 18 to 20, or let's say 20 miles, the 20 miles count when you get accumulator charge permanently. It means between, let's say, 8 o'clock in the morning and 8 o'clock in the evening. So you need, for the 20 miles, you need about 3 charges, and the charge needs about 3 to 4 hours. So you could drive, about 20 miles per hour. Every day, so the source charges from the solar panel.
Yeah, how much volume does your accumulator require, this tank that is the pressurized hydraulic tank?
There are about close to 15 gallons of fluid in those in the accumulator, yes.
What about contingencies such as, your braking, for example, is a computerized control system, so the more you push on the pedal, the more the regenerative system kicks in, so the brakes, you're basically running your motor backwards.
Yes.
To pressurize your accumulator.
Yes.
But if your computer went out for some reason, do you have a backup mechanical braking system?
I foresee a backup mechanical conventional braking system. So the wheel motors can be stopped also mechanically. That's what I'm planning. It's just for safety factor first, and second for the parking brake too.
You list three patents with this system. Two of them have to do with the engine and the fuel injection system on the engine.
Yes.
And what was the other one about?
The other one is the key item, is the hydraulic motor. Hydraulic motor has two patents, one from 1986, I believe, and the other one is from 2001. And they allow the very small and efficient production of a hydraulic motor. I mentioned only one patent for the hydraulic motor because the other one ran out in the meantime. But the one for 86 ran out a few years ago.
Mm. Now, you were mentioning in your this literature that you sent to me that the there's no power steering, or did I misunderstand that?
No, that's correct. Power steering is used to make the steering efforts low when you have a heavy car. I mean, the car is light, like this one here, the 130 miles per gallon car. When the car is light, you don't need a power steering, a power assist. You can use the normal, regular mechanics to steer the car without having a servo system that supports your efforts. So it saves.
What are you going to be using to keep the lights and the other electrical components of the vehicle?
The powertrain has a generator, like every other car, to charge the electric battery, because you need for radio, for accessories, for lights, and you need some extra power. And I have calculated that 10% of the energy is used for electricity, which is not used for driving. So the 130 miles a gallon is already the lower part of the consumption, considering that I need 10% for the electrical supplies, or for light and radio and so on.
Are you going to be, this is probably too far ahead to ask this kind of question, but a lot of modern vehicles have plugs for laptop computers, for an onboard television. Are you going to be accommodating those types of power needs?
Yes, this is. I think it's a normal requirement, and I will include it.
Okay. When you talk about having a solar panel on the roof and running a little electric motor that then drives the accumulator, and then the reverse of that, the generator being able to repower the battery running off the accumulator. How big is your battery system going to be?
The battery system is about half the size of the current car, because the battery of the current car has to be powerful to run the starter when you start the engine. So this needs a lot of power from the battery, and so I have a high size battery only for the supply, like a radio or other accessories. Since I don't have a starter, the starter of the engine here, of the three-piston engine, is hydraulically, so there's no electricity involved to start the engine.
So as you've got your solar panel, and it's not going into an electrical battery or chemical battery, it's going into the accumulator, which is a pressure battery, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So both the plug-in in the garage and the solar panel are kind of substitution for the engine, which means you can use a different procedure to charge the accumulator. That's the only thing why you have it. And the solar panel makes sense because I'm convinced that the investment for the solar panel in long time, the medium term, so that they say 2 or 3 years will pay off. And people who commute only, let's say, 10 miles to work, they would then have basically no fuel consumption, because most of the time the first 6 miles are free based on the solar panel energy.
Okay, so you have, in this system, you've got a lot of components. How what about your maintenance staff? The people are going to have to service this thing. Is it going to be something that a local mechanic is going to be able to work on, or are you going to have to take it to a special service center?
No, when the normal procedure how I plan it, when the car company produces a car with hydrostatic transmission, parallel or even before that, you will have technicians taught in this area. But basically, the engine is much simpler than current engines. What comes in addition is the maintenance of the hydraulic circuit. But maintenance of a hydraulic circuit is relatively simple. All things are lubricated, so there's no oil change or no kind of exotic maintenance. It's basically, it's a filter change, let's say, every 10,000 miles or what. So the maintenance, I expect, it will be less than the current automobiles because there are less components and simpler ones who drive the car.
There will be no oil change in this vehicle.
No oil will have been had to be changed, but I cannot tell you offhand in what kind of what the time frame. I know only that from areas where hydrostatic powertrains are used right now, like construction equipment, hydraulic excavator, and so on. You have a change every year. But it's nearly not comparable because current construction equipment or heavy equipment works in a very dirty environment. So for cars, the maintenance will be much less, or the change of oil will be much less, or much less often.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your company. The number, are you the only one, or do you have a team of people who are working with you? Tell us about what your company looks like.
My company looks like, as you assumed, I'm the only employee, and I do this full-time since 1984. I have designed a comparable powertrain for a company in Germany, so that's my background. And the engine was developed in the late 90s. I'm still the only employee. But for the development of the XPRIZE, I have planned and contacted several specialists and have fortunately gotten the support so far from four major internationally recognized scientists. One is Professor Dr. Reitz from Medicine, which is one of the leading individuals in combustion, and from Dr. Goldsboro here in Marquette University in Milwaukee, which is specializing on free piston engines, the air management, which is a very specific part, but both are very, very good in this area, and I really appreciate that they're willing to participate. So, after I have received sufficient funding for to build the car, then I will employ several engineers in certain areas to be able to manufacture the car, to build the car for the XPRIZE competition.
Undertaking to come up with an automobile company that's going to be producing a vehicle is a very huge undertaking. There's a lot of components, a lot of things involved. At what point will you need to build your team so that you can accomplish that objective and turn it from being just an idea into a reality?
The idea into a reality would come with developing the car for the XPRIZE. After this stage, or even during this stage, the platform, which is a key item of the car, I mean the drive system, the platform will be then basically ready for production. Typically, you adjust the prototype design, or let's say this stage of the design of a car. You modify it for mass production, but from there on, the remaining part, I mean the car body and electronics in the car and seating and the windshields and lights and those things, they are the same as today. So the amount needed for the car body is currently practiced. What is new is the car platform, and the car platform should be sufficiently finalized, the development finalized, to be able to produce in larger volume. And for this stage, I have a team of about 6-7 engineers in-house, planned in-house, and then when agreeing with car companies to produce a car, then they would use that their know-how to build the car body, and then the car body and the platform were basically assembled together, and then the car is complete.
Mm-hmm.
So the car body is in this case a separate entity. You can, let's say, you can have one platform determined by weight and by wheelbase, and put different car bodies on top of it, because there are only 4 points where you connect the car body to the platform, which is very simple and easy to produce.
But when we talk about the car body, one of the things about your design is that it could be lighter weight and even less rigid than a typical car body because of your active bumper system. Maybe we could talk about the bumper system for a minute.
I think this is, I obviously think it's a good idea. No, this comes automatically with hydraulic technology. The bumper system I have added to increase the safety of the car, and it works like as I'm now describing. When you hit the brakes very hard, or when the sensor noticed a car in front of you is approaching very fast, it means you are faster than the car in front of you, much faster, then the bumper comes out about 1.5 foot in front. And when you hit the obstacle, in this case a car, then the hydraulic cylinder behind the bumper will be compressed and absorb the energy from the impact. And then the hydraulic energy from the bumper goes back to the accumulator. This gives you about more braking assistance of these 1.5 foot, which means, based on calculation, when you hit a target or when you hit a wall or post with 25 miles an hour, then the car, then the bumper is able to absorb the whole braking energy. It means the car has no damage, but the bumper has absorbed the energy from the impact, which is, I think, a very good thing and could save a lot of...
In your literature, you said that the braking impact with that system would be about 16 Gs. That's still pretty intense on a human being.
That's high. Yeah. 16 G would be high. I think pilots or whatever are used to 7 Gs, but I've heard maybe a little more. But other slack or other movements in the car, for example, your body leaning forwards into the seatbelt and those things make it possible to expose the body to less G than 16. I would say significantly less G, but at least notably below 10 Gs. And on the other hand, in case it's practical to extend the extension of the bumper to be able to absorb more energy.
And the most important point is that it's going to be more cushion than what a typical vehicle would have under the same circumstances.
Yes, more cushion. First, more cushion, and second, without damage. That's the key. The other key item. When you have absorbed the impact, the energy has been absorbed by the active bumper, not by the car body. That's the reason my cars currently are relatively long in front, because they need about 10 inches, 12 inches of, I think 12 inches of space to absorb the impact from the energy from an impact. In this case, the active bumper takes over the energy absorption, which is currently taken by the car body.
Now, what about damage to the hydraulic system? You've got a lot of pressure in there, enough pressure to drive those wheels at 740 horse. If one of the tubes is severed or the chamber is severed somehow, is that going to create a hazard with the fluid squirting out or even exploding?
Exploding, no, but I think there's a maximum pressure of 7,000 psi. 7,000 psi can be handled safely today. There's no really limitation where you would say 10,000 psi wouldn't be possible anymore, but I've considered 7,000 psi, and this is commonly used, and when you design it careful, I mean, what I have planned, a double seal, so it doesn't, leakage is prevented, avoided by a factor of 2, 7,000 psi doesn't create any problems from the material side, but also from the side of sealing the pressure. This should be relatively easy to handle. obviously very careful design, but this is not another obstacle.
When you're talking about the tubes and the hosing to convey the hydraulic fluid, and you got the undercarriage of a vehicle, is there going to be any problem with rusting and other environmental exposure that those systems will have to the longevity of those parts?
No, I would say not. The components are even fewer than today. So the components are fewer, and there are no different technologies needed to reach the same level of qualification than currently. Typically, those parts currently are rust-protected or stainless steel, and I plan to do the same thing, in some cases even better, to prevent those aging influences. There shouldn't be any problem. As you might see on the, what you see on the website on the model, there are no hoses used to transmit the energy through the wheel motors. I have joints and steel tubes as part of the suspension. So there shouldn't be any problem. The hoses have lifetime limitations, I believe, especially when they're exposed to corrosive environment and so on. But that's the reason why I have included the transmission of the fluid to the wheels through the suspension, which is steel or stainless steel.
Just off the the topic question for you, I'm just curious, you have a foreign accent. What's your original, where are you from?
I'm from Germany.
Germany.
Uh-huh.
And what brought you to the U.S.?
I have worked, what I have briefly indicated before, for a company in Germany, a hydraulic company who made hydrostatic transmissions, and then after 11 years of experience and changed my direction a little bit, came to the United States. I have worked here for a hydraulic company and started then my business in 1982. And developing hydraulic components, and in 84 I came up with the improvement for the hydraulic motor, have patented in 86, have worked full time on it, and have additional improvements made which are covered by the patents you can see on the website, which includes, besides the hydraulic motor, different piston engine and the fuel injection system, which is very important.
That's a very long time to be involved in a project. You're still patient and you're plugging ahead. That's commendable.
Yes.
Are your patience wearing thin, or are you still good?
Yeah, it's a large project. It's something which you cannot finalize in a very short period of time. There's a lot of technical problems have to be solved. And I think now I'm in stage, and I'm very thankful that the XPRIZE came up to show that you have a fair chance to compete with established systems, and I think I can prove that there's a notable step possible.
One of the things we've not talked about yet is something you have in the beginning of your presentation that you sent me today, that this thing will run on multiple fuels. Maybe you can address that for a couple minutes.
Multiple fuels is obviously a positive part. Currently, the difficulties are you have to make a compromise between fuel consumption and emissions. And currently, the tendency is you have to improve the emissions also when you reduce the fuel consumption. The fuel consumption is obviously based on the engine, and a higher compression ratio is a better fuel consumption. And the three-piston engine is by nature able to change the compression ratio, and therefore you can basically combust or use principally almost any kind of fuel which contains energy. Currently, gasoline engines are obviously spark-ignited, and diesel engines are compression-ignited. But when you increase the compression, then you can also use fuels which need much higher temperature to start the ignition. That's the key item. How high the temperature has to be to start the ignition. And a lot of fuels need higher compression ratio or higher temperature, and the fuel-piston engine can handle basically all fuels which are currently known to be able to use in automobile, including raps oil and other things which might be a little more difficult.
So technically you could go to the gas station and fill up with any number of fuels, including those that are not at the gas station, maybe some lower grade fuels.
That's the idea. I think you can measure, you would measure the type of fuel. I don't know right now how you would measure it, but you can definitely measure the type of fuel and then adjust the program which runs the engine. It means when you have a fuel which needs a high temperature for combustion, then you would increase the combustion ratio. When you have a fuel which needs less temperature, then you would choose a different program to have a different combustion ratio.
What about the high pressure fuel injection? What's that about?
Currently, over the last years, maybe I start in the process. You inject the diesel fuel a short time before when you have reached a temperature of the compression in the cylinder, and the fuel ignites. The diesel fuel ignites because of the temperature in the piston, the combustion chamber. And the problem with current fuel injections is that the fuel injector presses in or pumps in the diesel fuel in high pressure through very small bores. They're about hair-sized holes to get a fine mist afterwards. So the fuel burns as a kind of mist. Unfortunately, there's still fluid involved. It's not only very fine drops, it's still fluid, and the fluid doesn't burn very well because there's not enough air in the cylinder, in the engine. And when you, what I'm planning is I don't inject the fuel from the inside, from one point, I inject it the outside under twice the pressure through half-size holes, so I get a very much finer mist, much better distributed. And this, those are the preconditions, this is known, those are the preconditions for almost homogeneous combustion. And homogeneous combustions have proven in the last 2-3 years that you can almost have an engine without any nitrogen oxide pollution and basically without soot, which is very good. And the FreeCast engine provides all preconditions for these conditions and uses less fuel. So I assume that the emissions can be reduced drastically, so between 80 or 90%.
One of the things about the free-piston engine that you do describe is you don't have the forces of the cross-grained forces that you might have in a where you have it hooked to a drivetrain, where it's just the combustion is going directly into energy, and you don't have the crankshaft angles of attack to deal with. How does the efficiency of the engine just by itself compare to the efficiency of an internal combustion engine? You show a chart on your handout where the internal combustion engine is about running at about 16% efficiency of turning fuel into driving energy, whereas in your hydrostatic powertrain, you're showing 37% of the energy is going into motion.
Yes. Current combustion engines lose a good amount of energy through friction. Piston rings, crankshaft, connection rod, and those things. The friction is area by about 15-20% in the engine. The other disadvantage is current engines versus current powertrains, I should say, is the engine runs from 800 RPM to 6,000 RPM between 2 horsepower and 150 horsepower. So over a very wide range, with very intensively changing power requirements and speed requirements. And this makes the engine, let's say, the current engine has, let's say, I don't know if I know the inch description, but engine, let's say, when the engine, current engine runs at 100 points, it runs at best points, it runs at about 180, 200 points under normal conditions because it has to go through the whole range of speeds and powers. The free-piston engine here runs only at the best point, it means at 100, minus the lack of friction inside. So I can go basically go from 100 to 85 to a much lower consumption compared to the much higher consumption from a normal regular combustion engine. So therefore, the efficiency of the free piston engine is notably higher than the current engine.
Let's talk for a second about what's underneath the hood. How big is this engine that's running your the accumulator, and how many other components are going to be under the hood? What's it going to look like?
The engine is about 2 feet long, about a half foot, a little more than a half. Let's say it's about 20 inches wide. I should even take a look to be accurate. The engine will be about 2 feet long, about 7 inches wide, and about 1 foot high. So it's a relatively small package you can basically carry with one hand, and it weighs about 45 pounds, I believe. Kilogram. So it's 70 pounds for the engine, and it's 24 inches by 6.5 inches by 12.5 inches. It's a small package, mm-hmm. with a kind of combustion pump. It's not really an engine as we know it right now.
This is it's not going to be that you don't have the air filter. What about that?
It's part of it. The engine is has a relatively small displacement of a half a liter, which is about a quarter of a current engine of a smaller engine. It's or 30 cubic inches. It's a very small engine, but it works at very high pressure. That makes it small.
What is going to be eliminated in your engine that exists in a present engine?
There are two pistons which run in opposite directions, so there's no vibration. But the key item is no crankshaft, no oil pan, no connection rod, no carburetor, no spark plugs. It's very, very simple. It's basic, but you said before, it's combustion pressure. Is transferred directly into hydraulic pressure. There's only one piston transfers the forces.
Well, we are running near the end of our 55 minutes here. Is there anything that we've not touched on that you want to address really quickly?
No, I think we have talked about efficiency. I would maybe once more state the pollution. Maybe as a summary, it's using only one-fifth of the fuel. It means much less fuel burned, much cleaner. It's a guarantee that the pollution is drastically lower. That's what I would like to underline here. And we have touched the active bumper, which I think will reduce damage to the driver, or injuries to the driver and damage to the car. We have touched partly that the powertrain platform is disconnected, or it's a separate part of the car consists of the body and the powertrain.
Give us your website.
Excuse me? I would recommend taking a look at the website, yes, which is www.valentintechnologies.com, which explains the system, I think, pretty good.
We also have created a feature page about you at peswiki.com, PESWIKI. Again, we've been speaking with Ingo Valentin. He is the inventor of a technology that will result in a 130-mile-per-gallon passenger vehicle that hopefully will be available at a comparable price to what we're paying for present passenger vehicles by the year 2015. And that's just 7 years out, hopefully winning the X Prize in a couple of years. It looks good to do that at this point. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. Goodbye.
listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.
You're listening to BBS Radio. An internet radio experience of truth, harmony, beauty. From your family at BBS Radio, have yourself a beautiful day.